Today is Friday, October 22nd, and you're listening to International Edition under Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, White House reworks infrastructure bill amid Democrats wrangling.
Congressional Democrats are working to cut down their domestic policy plan to $2 trillion, but they're not there yet.
Plus, ASEAN hardens stance on Myanmar military leaders. Also, UN launches plan to help millions of Afghans who lost their livelihoods. Our top story today is in the U.S. The White House and Democrats are hurriedly reworking key aspects of President Joe Biden's $2 trillion domestic policy plan. They are trimming the social services and climate change programs, and they are reconsidering new taxes on corporations and the wealthy to pay for the package. The ideas including shelving a proposed big increase in corporate tax rates while adding a new tax on investment gains of the very richest Americans. Biden acknowledges the challenge he still faces in wrangling the sharply divergent factions within the Democratic Party to agree to the final contours of the bill. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
President Joe Biden's signature domestic policy plan still hasn't been finalized. Congressional Democrats are working to cut down their domestic policy plan to $2 trillion, but they're not there yet. At her weekly news conference Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Although it's a smaller bill, it's still historic, transformational, and will make an enormous difference.
Democratic leaders were hoping to have the package finalized by today, but Senator Joe Manchin, one of two key centrists whose concerns must be taken into account, says he won't sign off on anything before he's read the legislative language.
There's a lot of detail. Until you see the text and the fine print, it makes it pretty hard.
Paying for it all remains a vexing problem, with plans to raise the corporate tax rate now on the back burner. To help cut the bill to $2 trillion, Democrats are trimming social services and climate change programs. Mike Gracia, Washington.
China's foreign ministry urged the United States on Friday to avoid sending any wrong signals to proponents of Taiwanese independence after President Joe Biden said the United States would come to the Chinese claimed island's defense. China has no room for concessions when it comes to its core interests, adding that, quote, no external interference is allowed, unquote, ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin told a daily news briefing in Beijing. The United States would come to Taiwan's defense and has a commitment to defend the island China claims as its own, U.S. President Joe Biden said on Thursday, though the White House said later there was no change in policy towards the island. China says Taiwan is the most sensitive and important issue in its ties with the United States and has denounced what it calls, quote, collusion, unquote, between Washington and Taipei. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin on Friday offered the United States, quote, resolute, unquote, commitment to NATO and broad support both to Taiwan and the European Union.
Nobody wants to see trade issues come to blows, certainly not President Biden, and there's no reason that it should. You've heard us say this a number of times. I'll say it again. We remain committed to one China policy in keeping with Taiwan Relations Act, three assurances, and the six communiques. As we've done over multiple administrations, we'll continue to help Taiwan with the sorts of capabilities that it needs to defend itself, and so we'll stay focused on those things.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. The UN Special Envoy for Myanmar is warning that February's military takeover has led to armed conflict, and if power isn't returned to the people in a democratic way, the country will go in the direction of a failed state. Christine Schreiner-Bergina told UN reporters Thursday that the conflict between the military and civilians and ethnic minorities is intensifying in many parts of the country. This, as Malaysian Foreign Minister Saifuddin Abdullahi said on Thursday, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, should rethink its decade-long policy of non-interference in the affairs of member states amid a worsening human rights crisis in Myanmar. The 10-member bloc on Friday made an unprecedented move to exclude the leader of Myanmar's junta from an upcoming regional summit over a lack of progress over a peace plan it agreed to with ASEAN in April.
As much as the issue in Myanmar is local and national, but it has impact on the region, and we should also recognize the concerns of the other nine member states. And I also stated the fact that we cannot use the principle of non-interference as a shield to avoid issues being addressed. So I would like to then invite you to perhaps look into the possibility that maybe this is now time for ASEAN to do serious soul searching on the application of the principle of non-interference and look at other experiences of other regions. Is there a way of moving from the principle of non-interference to, number one, for example, redefining the concept or the principle of constructive engagement, and number two, innovating so that it's relevant to our context, the experience of the African Union when they move away from non-interference to non-indifference.
Thus, Malaysian Foreign Minister Saifuddin Abdallah. The UN Development Programme is launching a plan to help millions of Afghans who have lost their livelihoods amid the recent political turmoil regain the ability to earn a living and feed their families. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The speed and degree to which Afghanistan's economy has imploded since the Taliban gained control of the country in mid-August is breathtaking. Most affected are the country's 38 million people, many of whom are unable to support themselves. The latest assessment by the UN Development Program forecasts 97% of households in Afghanistan could sink below the poverty line by early to mid-2022 if the country's political and economic crisis is not urgently addressed. UNDP Administrator Achim Steiner acknowledges the country is in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. At the same time, however, he says measures must be taken to keep the local economies going. He says international aid alone cannot keep 38 million Afghans alive.
We have to step in, we have to stabilize a people's economy, and in addition to saving lives in the immediate, we also have to save livelihoods, because otherwise we will confront indeed a scenario through this winter and into next year where millions and millions of Afghans are simply unable to stay on the land, in their homes, in their villages, and survive.
The UNDP has established a special trust fund for Afghanistan to protect the hard-won development gains the country has achieved over the past 20 years. Countries can channel funding for specific development and livelihood projects through this program. Kani Wignaraja is Assistant Secretary General and Director of the Regional Bureau for Asia Pacific. She says the money will go directly to community groups and community members.
It will provide a cash for work to support small public works efforts. As Achim said, it will provide a temporary basic income for the most vulnerable, including elderly and disabled. It will work with a number of UN agencies, with international and national NGO partners who are on the ground.
UNDP estimates $667 million will be needed to cover the cost of livelihood activities for 4.5 million Afghans in the first year. It hopes to double the number of beneficiaries in the second year if it is able to double the size of funding. The agency says the launch of the trust fund is off to a good start, with a contribution of 50 million euros from the German government. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
More than 50,000 Afghan refugees who are now housed at a U.S. military base will be resettled throughout the United States in coming months. The largest number will be heading for California and Texas. Michael Sullivan reports the Afghan-American community and local officials are getting ready.
Afghan-Americans in California protest what they call the Taliban government's repressive and cruel behavior during separate rallies in San Diego and Los Angeles in August and September. Now they're preparing for the arrival of Afghan refugees. One aid worker says the refugees are relieved to have fled a country led by the Taliban. Fayez Nawabi is policy and advocacy manager for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, California.
They're also very thankful that America was able to accept them, and then also that the MEMSA community, the Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, South Asian community, worked really hard to pool resources to help these individuals find housing, to help pay for basic necessities.
One Afghan-American who worked as an interpreter for U.S. forces resettled in the U.S. with a special immigrant visa in late 2012. He's helping to store supplies for newcomers, but also worries about Afghans left behind. Former U.S. interpreter Lutfullah Saadet.
People are losing their lives. Taliban are searching. They are saying one thing but doing another thing.
Saadet says dozens of his family members are living in fear in Afghanistan, including a brother who once worked for U.S. forces. Millions of Afghans have fled war in the country over the last 40 years. The U.N. Refugee Agency says 90% of those refugees now live in Iran and Pakistan. Saadet says the U.S. and its allies must help those who helped them and pressure the Taliban to respect human rights. Former interpreter and Afghan refugee Lutfullah Saadet.
The solution should be that how should we make sure that the Taliban has a good government, a very inclusive government that represents all of the race and ethnicities in Afghanistan, not just from one tribe, not just from one political party.
California will receive more than 5,000 Afghan refugees in the first group. Some communities are asking for federal help and for locals to step up, too. San Diego County Supervisor Joel Anderson.
All these folks need placement, and it makes sense that they're placed with people that speak the same language that can help them immigrate.
Afghan Americans are not optimistic about the future of their homeland, but still hope for change, says Fayez Nawabi.
We want to see an Afghanistan that is free, an Afghanistan that is peaceful, an Afghanistan that believes in human rights for all people.
In the meantime, tens of thousands of Afghan refugees will join others who have built a better life in America. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
New Zealand scientists have found that microplastics have a direct impact on global warming. They published the first study linking airborne plastic fragments and fibers to climate change on Wednesday. They also found that microplastics, which have been widely detected on land and in rivers and oceans, are detrimental to health. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This is the first study to investigate the effects of airborne microplastics on climate. The plastic fragments and fibers are carried by the wind. Microplastics are created by the breakdown of carpets, clothing and paint, as well as tyres and larger plastics that degrade over time. Researchers in New Zealand have found that, for now, their influence on climate change is small. But if the global average concentration of microplastics increases to levels already seen in some cities, the impact will be significant, they say. Laura Revelle is an atmospheric chemist at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. She says the airborne particles do affect the environment.
They are good at scattering solar radiation or sunlight back to space, which causes a minor cooling influence on Earth's climate. And they also are quite good at absorbing the infrared radiation that's emitted by the Earth, which means they also contribute to the greenhouse effect. But overall, it's that interaction with sunlight that plays out. So overall, they have a very, very small cooling influence on Earth's climate.
Revelle says laboratory studies have shown that microplastics can damage lung tissue. Aquatic organisms such as zooplankton can also mistake the plastic for food, which can interfere with the ocean's carbon cycle, where carbon is recycled naturally by the environment.
I wouldn't want anyone to get the idea that this is actually a good thing in terms of climate change and that they're offsetting the effects of greenhouse gas warming, because for a start, the effect is very small in the present day. And then there are also these other damaging effects to humans and to other ecosystems.
Researchers have estimated that globally, 5 billion tons of plastic waste have accumulated in landfills and the natural environment to date. They've warned that amount could double over the next 30 years if current trends in plastic production and waste management continue. The research is a collaboration between New Zealand's University of Canterbury and Victoria University of Wellington. It's published in the leading scientific journal Nature. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
This is the Voice of America. Nepalese authorities are searching for dozens of people missing in this week's heavy rains, floods and landslides, as survivors complain they have yet to receive any government help. Police say the death toll has crossed 100 in the country's eastern and western parts. At least 40 others have been injured by landslides and house collapses, and another 41 people are missing. Rescue teams are relocating people to safer locations and taking dozens of injured to hospitals. Russian President Vladimir Putin has hosted Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett for the first meeting, hailing friendly ties between the two countries. Welcoming Bennett at the start of their talk, Putin hailed Russian-Israeli ties as, quote, unique, unquote, saying that, quote, our dialogue, our relations, rely on a very deep connection between our peoples, unquote. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. In Belarus, just over the border from Ukraine, many children have been living with chronic radiation sickness since the reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded in 1986. They have returned to school after being unable to escape contamination for yet another summer due to pandemic border restrictions. For VOA, Ricardo Marquina has more from the Gomel region of southern Belarus in this report, narrated by Miguel Amaya.
In southern Belarus, people are used to living with radiation contamination from the Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident more than 30 years ago. In this agricultural region, crops grow on polluted land. Families make an average of 150 a month, and poverty forces children to eat food from their gardens, which implies a health risk.
After the Chernobyl accident, checking the entire territory was not possible, and it turned out that there was radiation everywhere, also here. There are no totally clean areas. You can't close off the air.
Since 2020, COVID has added to the threat of radiation. For 2 years in a row, children have been unable to travel elsewhere in Europe for their summer break due to pandemic restrictions. Children here often spend their holidays outside the region with host families in Europe, something that aid groups say is essential for their health. The Chernobyl Childhood Federation, a Spanish aid group led by Amai Arcega, organizes the children's travel. She says reports by the World Health Organization suggest time away from contaminated land can be life-saving for children.
With that, we are saying a lot. The possibility of suffering from childhood cancer is greatly reduced.
For some of these children, poverty and radiation are compounded by living in broken families, often due to parents' alcohol abuse. Cases of fetal alcohol syndrome are common.
It's obvious alcohol affects the fetus. In a pregnancy, alcohol has a big effect.
Children like Maxim, abandoned by an alcoholic mother and adopted by uncles, had the hope of spending their first months in Spain, something that, due to COVID, will have to wait perhaps another year. For Ricardo Marquina in the Gomel region of Belarus, Miguel Amaya, VOA News.
This week, Americans and others around the world are reflecting on the life and legacy of Colin Powell, the first black U.S. Secretary of State and top military officer who died on Monday at the age of 84. Powell's family said he passed away from complications due to COVID-19. He was fully vaccinated, but have been battling multiple myeloma, a cancer of plasma cells that suppresses the immune system. In addition to being a statesman, those close to him say he was also a great friend. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob spoke to retired Army Colonel Joe Schwab, whose friendship with Powell spanned six decades, about how Schwab would like his friend remembered.
Joe Schwab met Colin Powell in early 1959. Both were brand new Army second lieutenants stationed in Germany.
He was a bachelor. I was married. He knew basically where to get a free meal. So the three of us became fairly good friends. I would say very good friends during the 2 years that we served together.
Schwar's next assignment was at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Now, Schwar is a white man from the northern state of Pennsylvania. He said Powell was one of the first black men he ever knew. Schwarr wasn't too familiar with the racial rules in the segregated South, which often mandated separate facilities for blacks and whites until the mid-1960s. He had been on base in North Carolina about a year when...
There was a knock on my door, opened up, and there was Colin Powell with his brand new bride. Colin was distraught because he couldn't find a place that he considered satisfactory for his new bride. It was, I believe it was the Jim Crow at work there. I guess my wife and I looked at each other and without blinking an eye basically said, stay with us.
Powell and his wife Alma, the Schwarrs, and their young kids shared their three-bedroom apartment for 6 weeks until Powell finished his training to deploy to Vietnam, and Alma went to live with her family during his deployment.
As long as we stayed on Fort Bragg, we could go anywhere together. We could do anything together. Once or twice, my wife and Alma went down into Fayetteville, and Alma was very sensitive about being an African-American. She educated my wife, basically, on what she could and could not do. And my wife had a little rebellious spirit, and she could not understand why Alma allowed this to happen.
He said the prejudice Alma Powell saw growing up in the South perhaps led to her caution years later when her husband was considering a run for president.
She was concerned about him, not his ability to serve as president, but his physical security serving as president. And I believe she talked him out of it.
After that fateful deployment to Germany in 1959, Schwarr and Powell continued to cross paths. They fought just a few kilometers apart in Vietnam. They also studied at Fort Benning together.
Fast forward to the mid-70s. I was on my way to the Pentagon for an assignment. Colin had already been in the Pentagon for a year when I got there. As things happen in the military, you get there, your house isn't ready for you, your furniture hasn't arrived yet. So we're having dinner with Colin and Alma, and I mentioned the house isn't going to be ready for a while, blah, 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 blah. Colin says, Alma, start doubling up the kids in the rooms. The Schwarrs are moving in with us.
And that, Schwarr says, was just typical Powell. A regular guy, a regular good guy. Someone a young Schwarr never suspected would one day rise to be a four-star general and Secretary of State.
One of the most unforgettable people that I served with. Just a consistent, outstanding record of performance. He was never pretentious. He was a man of his word. What you see is what you get.
And what the nation got was decade upon decade of steadfast service. Powell will be remembered at the Pentagon as one of the greats, following in the footsteps of George Marshall, a general turned Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, and paving the way for generals like former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and current Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. But Powell's kindness and his dedication to country, family, and friends are what Schwarr wants the world to remember. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Environmental campaigners have staged protests on several continents to press their demands for more government action to curb global warming ahead of the upcoming UN climate summit in Glasgow. Protesters rallied in Uganda, Bangladesh, India, and Germany to call for measures that prevent dangerous levels of warming and take account of the plight of the world's poorest, who are particularly hard hit by climate change. Thousands of mostly young people rallied in Berlin's iconic Brandenburg Gate, with many carrying banners calling on the next German government to place greater emphasis on tackling climate change. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinua in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant weekend.